Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Okay, today we will be taking the Potaliya Sutta, which is Sutta number 54 in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses. And again, to sketch in just a little bit of the background to this sutta, or to this section of suttas that we're taking now. Up until last week, previous section, a group of suttas that we had studied, were concerned with describing the way to achieve happiness and fulfillment within the round of existence, within samsara. So those are suttas that are concerned with the law of karma and its result, the way to avoid unfortunate type of rebirth, the way to cultivate the causes and conditions that will lead to a pleasant rebirth, to success and good fortune within the round of existence. Those suttas also dealt with basic ethical observances, observance of precepts, the achievement of harmony and cooperation between people, the avoidance of anger, development of patience, and other virtues which are of a worthy but still mundane nature. And now we are moving towards those suttas which deal with the path to liberation. And in order to prepare the groundwork for those suttas describing, explaining, expounding the path to liberation, we are studying a number of suttas which highlight from different angles the unsatisfactoriness, the inherent inadequacy and flawed nature of all conditioned existence. Last week we studied the great discourse on the mass of suffering, the Mahadukkha Kanda Sutta, which dealt with the flaws and unsatisfactoriness in sensual pleasures, in the body or physical form, and in feeling. Now this sutta will again highlight in a different way the unsatisfactory nature or the danger in sensual pleasures. And the sutta takes place when the Buddha was living in the Anguttarapa country at a town named Apana. I believe the Anguttarapa country would have been someplace in the far east of the region of India where the Buddha lived and taught. Perhaps it extended even as far, it was located even as far east as the state of Bengal, where Bengal is today. Okay, and in the sutta, the Buddha is not accompanied by the order of monks, but he has separated himself from the monks and has gone on his alms round alone. Then after his alms round, he goes for his meal to a certain grove, a forest grove, and he sits down at the root of a tree. And while he is sitting there, a householder by the name of Potaliya, who is taking a walk for exercise, comes to the grove and approaches the Blessed One and exchanges greetings with him. And there seems to be some background story to this, but I looked in the commentary. A commentary doesn't give any explanation. And I looked in Malalasekara's Dictionary of Pali Proper Names, and it just gives the information about Potaliya based on this sutta. But there seems to be some underlying text or significance which is not quite clear to me. And so Potaliya comes to the Buddha And he's wearing a full dress. He's dressed in a quite elegant way. He's carrying a parasol and wearing sandals. Perhaps to us this does not seem very significant, but seen against the background of the social conditions of this period, the cultural conditions, he would be dressed and carrying himself somewhat like we call a dandy. And yet he thinks of himself as being a renunciant or an ascetic, as we will see. And so when you carry a parasol, it's like a mark of prestige or class. And even wearing sandals, in those days, ascetics would not wear sandals, but they would go barefoot unless they have some sore feet, delicate feet, and they would wear very basic, very primitive sandals. But he must have been wearing decorated sandals, maybe with animal figures, polka dots, paisley design. And so when he exchanges, after exchanging greetings with the Buddha says to him, "There are seats, householder. Sit down if you like." Of course, there wouldn't be chairs there, but he's saying, in effect, pull up a pile of leaves or a log of a tree and sit down. But the household of Bhotaliya becomes angry and displeased because thinking that the Buddha has addressed me as a householder. He thinks he's a renunciant, an ascetic. And so he just stands there keeping silent. And then a second and a third time the Buddha says to him, "Sit down, householder." And the second time and the third time, the household of Bhotaliya is angry and displeased. And the third time that the Buddha addresses him, then Bhotaliya can no longer restrain his anger, but he says that it's not fitting, not correct for you to be addressing me as a householder. Then the Buddha says to him that for all practical purposes, he looks like a householder. He's wearing full dress quite elegantly, carrying a parasol, a sunshade, wearing sandals. And so Bhotaliya explains, he says, "I have given up all my works and I have cut off all of my affairs." And the Buddha asks him, "How have you done so?" And he says that he has given all of his wealth, all of his property to his children, and then he still lives with them, and they provide him with food and clothing and other basic requisites, but he just keeps aloof from them and doesn't interfere with their affairs. And so he's, in effect, he's like living like a retired elder with his children. But he thinks that because he's not doing any more work, not earning his living, that he's given up all my works and he's cut off all of his affairs. And this becomes like the theme of the discourse of the sutta, this idea of cutting off one's affairs. This is a rather unusual expression. It's not a typical expression in the suttas. I don't recall any other sutta where one encounters this expression. But the Buddha will use it as a foundation stone for constructing for a discourse. And so the Buddha says to him that the cutting off of affairs, as you describe it, is one thing, but in the Arya Vinaya, that is, the discipline of the Noble One, the cutting off of affairs is something quite different. And here this important expression, vohara samucheda, has several shades of meaning. The commentary explains, first, the usual typical meaning of vohara is business dealings. Vyavahara means to conduct transactions, to sell and buy things. Then it has another shade of meaning, vohara, as expression or term of reference. And here, of course, to become a true renunciant in the Buddha sense means first that one gives up all business dealings, all buying and selling. Then vohara has the other sense of a designation or a label, a labeling, designation, expression, label. And so here the Buddha is going to explain how one gives up the designation of being a householder and becomes a true renunciant. And then the third sense of vohara is volition or intention. These will be intentions that keep one bound within the round of existence. Particularly at the deepest level, vohara seems to be referring to the fundamental defilements, the deep underlying defilements which keep one in bondage. Okay, so when the Buddha opens or throws out this theme by drawing a contrast between the cutting off of affairs as Potellia conceives it, and the way affairs are cut off in the Noble One's discipline, Potellia gets, his interest is aroused, and he asks the Buddha to explain to him what is meant by cutting off affairs in the Noble One's discipline. And so the Buddha begins first with a very concise explanation. And he says that first that there are these eight things in the Noble One's discipline that lead to the cutting off of affairs. And in the outline, I've highlighted, I've italicized the words lead to indicate that this is not the actual cutting off of affairs, but these are preparatory stage for the cutting off of affairs. And there are eight things. One is the abandoning the killing of living beings. And this is done with the support of the non-killing of living beings. In other words, it seems, by taking the precept of not to kill living beings. Again, with the support of taking only what is given, one abandons the taking of what is not given. One observes the precept to abstain from taking what is not given. Again, one undertakes the precept to abandon false speech. And one makes the commitment to speak truth. So, with the support of truthful speech, false speech is to be abandoned. Then the following items are not governed by actual precepts, but they are guidelines to right conduct. Here, with the support of unmalicious speech, malicious speech is to be abandoned. Malicious speech means, this is pisunavacha in Pali, speech which breaks up friendships and harmony between people. In other words, this is slanderous speech, speech which is intended to set at variance people who are living together in harmony. And so one makes a determination never to speak anything which is malicious, which has the intention of dividing people who are united. Then one makes a determination to refrain from excessive greed, from strong, intense selfishness and greed. And in this way, one abandons this rapacious greed, or one abandons behavior motivated by rapacious greed. Then one makes a determination to refrain from spiteful behavior, from scolding and reviling others. And in this way, spiteful actions and scolding and railing against others is abandoned. And then the next phrase, I don't know that it's translated correctly here. It's kodupayasa. Now I would take it almost as being two items, anger and despair. Or maybe it could be misery produced through anger. So one makes a determination to, I would understand it to mean that one makes a determination to refrain from anger. And by refraining from anger, then one abandons the despair and misery that arise when one burns and blazes with anger. And then with the support of non-arrogance, arrogance is to be abandoned. Arrogance here is, in Pali, the word is atimana. Mana is usually translated conceit. That means thinking highly of oneself. And atimana is thinking so highly of oneself that one looks down at others and condemns others. One has a kind of contemptuous, haughty attitude towards others on account of one's high estimation, high overvaluation of oneself. Okay, now Potalia is somewhat perplexed by this very concise statement of the Buddha. And so he says that he would appreciate it if the Buddha would explain to him in detail these eight things that lead to the cutting off of affairs. And so now the Buddha is going to explain how a noble disciple embraces or takes up these eight things that lead to the cutting off of affairs. Here we move to paragraph 6. Okay, we begin with the principle, with the support of the non-killing of living beings, the killing of living beings is to be abandoned. What is the meaning of this? Here, a noble disciple reflects, I am practicing the way to the abandoning and cutting off of those fetters because of which I might kill living beings. This is a very important word in the Buddha's teachings that we come across again and again, the word fetters. The word fetter usually means the defilements or mental afflictions in their function or role of keeping one in bondage to the round of rebirths, the round of repeated becoming. And the noble path of the Buddha is proclaimed precisely to show, to bring about the cutting off of these fetters, so that when all of the fetters are cut, one gains final liberation. Usually the texts, as we will see later, enumerate 10 fetters. This is the classical formulation. 10 defilements that keep one in bondage. But But sometimes more succinctly, they reduce the fetters to the three: greed, hatred, and delusion. So here we consider, or the noble disciple considers, that he is practicing the way, the path, to cut off these fetters that keep one in bondage. And the grossest way these fetters keep one in bondage is by motivating unwholesome bodily, verbal, and mental action. Okay, so now to encourage himself in his effort to abandon the fetters, he reflects that first, if I were to kill living beings, I would blame myself for doing so. In other words, having undertaken a discipline, a training, in which one commits oneself to observe the principle of harmlessness, of non-injury. If one were to violate that principle and to kill living beings, then one would feel the pain brought about by one's own conscience. And then one would blame oneself. And this activity of restraining oneself from any kind of harmful or unwholesome behavior on account of fear of self-blame, this is an expression of a particular quality that is called in Buddhism the sense of shame, or in Pali, hiri. The Buddha speaks of two basic or two mental factors, two qualities, principles, which are, in a sense, the underlying springs of moral behavior. One is the sense of shame. The other is fear of wrongdoing or moral dread. In Pali, hiri and otappa. Through the sense of shame, one doesn't want to commit unwholesome action because it will disturb one's own conscience. And one experiences a sense of oppression, of affliction, through the reminder in one's own mind that one has committed unwholesome action. One is falling from one's sense of honor, so to speak, one's inner sense of honor. But the sense of moral dread is a fear of the consequences of unwholesome behavior. And one of these is that if one engages in unrighteous action here and now, other people, the people that one respects, the wise and virtuous people, might investigate one's behavior and criticize you for doing so. And then the other aspect is that by engaging in such unwholesome action, one creates unwholesome karma, unskillful karma, which could lead to an unhappy rebirth, a rebirth even in the plains of misery. Okay, then the noble disciple reflects that this killing of living beings is itself a fetter and a hindrance. Here again, the text uses two important doctrinal terms. One is fetter, sanyojana, which I just discussed. The other, hindrance, in Pali, it's the word nivarana. And the classical form of nivaranas, hindrances, are five mental states, which are called hindrances because they block one's progress in meditation. We'll come across these in later suttas just very quickly. That they are sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse and doubt. But here the Buddha is saying that the killing of living beings itself is a fetter, in the sense that it binds one to the round of existence, and it's a hindrance in the sense that it blocks one's progress on the path to liberation. And then he says that while taints, vexation, and fever might arise through the killing of living beings, there are no taints, vexation, and fever for one who abstains from killing living beings. Here again, there's an important doctrinal word here. The word is asavas, which is translated taints. Usually the word asava has the sense of very deeply grounded defilements, again, that keep one flowing along in the round of samsara. But here I think the word is used in a somewhat different sense, more to imply just troubles or difficulties. And it's grouped together with vexation or disturbance. Vexation, disturbance, distress. Yeah. It was vigata, distress. And then fever. Fever, it's not the fever that you get when you have a sickness, but it's a kind of burning of the mind that takes place when one engages in this morally unwholesome action. And so, by abstaining from the killing of living beings, one eliminates, to some extent, this fetter and hindrance which consists in the taking of life, and one avoids the troubles, the distress, and mental turmoil that arise or that occur, even in very subtle ways in the mind, when one habitually or even occasionally engages in killing. Okay, and then the same type of reflection is applied to the other seven cases. And all of them are speaking about how, with the support of one quality, one virtuous or wholesome quality, either a precept or a disposition, determination of the mind, a certain unwholesome quality, an unwholesome action or unwholesome state of mind, is to be abandoned. And this leads into the important theme of abandonment or abandoning. This is, again, a certain key word that comes repeatedly in the text, the word pahana. Sometimes it's translated getting rid of, abandoning, elimination, giving up. And the commentaries explain that there are three stages or types of abandoning. And this is a very useful interpretative school, a very useful interpretative rule for understanding the suttas. Okay, one is abandoning by way, abandoning by way of factor substitution. Okay, what this means is that one uses a particular wholesome factor, wholesome quality, as a means for abandoning or pushing away an unwholesome quality, which is the exact opposite of it. And this is what is involved when one undertakes precepts. When one undertakes the precepts, then one takes a guideline to right action. One makes a commitment to that guideline, and that serves to enable one to abandon the unwholesome type of behavior, which is its exact opposite. And one uses this type of factor substitution, well, if one is training oneself many times during the day when, say, an unwholesome state of an unwholesome thought arises, then one looks at that thought, considers that it's an unwholesome thought, and one will use some reflection to remove it temporarily. Say, if it's an angry thought, then you might think, there's a, angry thoughts are very dangerous. If I give way to this angry thought, I'll create trouble for myself, trouble for others. And so one uses this reflection to eliminate temporarily this unwholesome thought. If a thought of pride or arrogance arises, then one can reflect on anatta, on non-self, that there's no real self. Why should I be proud of this? Why should I be conceited on account of that? Everything is due to causes and conditions. And so now one is using kind of reflective wisdom to control and to remove these unwholesome thoughts. Okay, but this type of factor substitution is not very secure, not very reliable. So the next stage in abandoning defilements is called in Pali Vikambana Bahana, which is translated abandoning by suppression. Now, suppression is not in favor these days in this post-Freudian era, but suppression here doesn't mean repression, that is pushing something away without being aware of it. But this is the removal of defilements from the surface of the mind by training the mind in concentration so that one can develop a strong samadhi, a power of mental absorption, and the mind becomes very clear and pure. But this clarity and purity of mind does not come through the elimination, ultimate elimination of the defilements, but through the force of mental concentration. In this case, to compare with factor substitution might be compared to if there is a rotten peg in a block of wood and you want to get rid of it, say it's performed some important function, you want to get rid of it, then you take a hammer and another peg and you knock it out. But now, abandoning by suppression, this is like if you have water with a lot of mud in the water, mixed in the water. You let the water stand until the mud settles to the bottom of the bowl. Then you have clear water inside the bowl, but still there's mud on the bottom. Okay, so the next stage in abandoning is called abandoning by eradication. This is the complete elimination of the defilements by cutting off their subtle underlying roots. And this is the function of prajna, or wisdom. This is like after the mud has settled in the cup, this is like scooping out the mud so that there's no more mud remaining in the cup. Okay, now up to this point, what the Buddha has been explaining are methods of abandoning these unwholesome states, these eight unwholesome states, through factor substitution. In other words, this whole training that's been described so far to overcome these eight undesirable qualities is a training in moral discipline or moral restraint. Moral restraint, in some cases, of bodily action, as one when one avoids killing and stealing. Restraint over verbal action, moral restraint over verbal action, when one avoids false speech, malicious speech, scolding of others. And then there is restraint of mental action, the morality or virtue of mental restraint, when one avoids rapacious greed, angry despair, and arrogance. Okay, so now the Buddha, in paragraph 14, he says, these eight things that lead to the cutting off of affairs in the Noble One's discipline have now been expounded in detail. But the cutting off of affairs in the Noble One's discipline has not yet been achieved entirely and in all ways. And so again, the Buddha is sort of enticing Potaliya, who originally was quite proud and even arrogant, but now Potaliya is being humbled by being given these cryptic statements which he doesn't understand, so that he'll ask questions and the Buddha will answer the questions, leading Potaliya deeper and deeper. So now Potaliya asked the Buddha if he would explain how the cutting off of affairs is achieved entirely and in all ways. And the Buddha sets out to explain to him. But the Buddha doesn't do so in a very direct way. But now the Buddha is going to show the way to the deeper meditative attainments by highlighting, underscoring the danger, the unsatisfactoriness, the flawed nature of sensual pleasures. And the Buddha is doing this in order to show, again, or let us say, to pave the way to the attainment of the jhanas, or meditative absorptions. Because the meditative absorptions, the deep stages of deep samadhi, depend upon the overcoming of sensual desire. The formula for the first jhana, the first absorption, says vivijeva kamehi vivicha akusalehi dhammehi. That is, by separating oneself from sensual pleasures, by separating oneself from unwholesome states of mind, one enters and dwells in the first jhana, the first absorption. And so to prepare the mind for the attainment of the absorptions, one has to attenuate, weaken the grip of sensual desire on the mind. And the Buddha prepares his disciples for this by teaching them the unsatisfactoriness or flawed nature of sensual pleasures. And sometimes he uses these similes. If anybody has a delicate stomach, I will give you a moment to leave. These are rather strong. And this is not the way the Buddha typically explains discourses to householders. But it seems Potaliya must have had some hidden potential for the Buddha to use these very powerful similes. Okay, first there's a simile of a dog waiting, a hungry, weak dog waiting outside a butcher's shop. And you who are living in the West, you don't know what a dog lives like in Asia, in South Asia. Sometimes you see these dogs. They don't have homes, they're not taken care of, but they just wander the streets. they get their meals entirely by chance. If people throw food out, they'll get something to eat. But the weaker, but whenever people throw things away, there will be maybe 20, 30 dogs waiting for the food to be disposed of. And so they'll all come running to get the food. And the weaker dogs are repeatedly being elbowed out, and they don't get anything. So we have, sometimes you see these dogs, which are very thin, very ravished with hunger. And so now a butcher is working in the butcher shop, and he cuts off the meat from the carcass of a cow or some other animal. He sees the dog waiting there, and he's cut off all of the meat, but he just, out of sympathy, he throws this bone, the set of bones out the shop. And the dog catches the smell of the meat and thinks, now I'm going to get a good meal, comes running, and he finds just this bone, set of bones, and he nibbles and gnaws on the bones, but all he gets is a little of the blood that's smeared on the bones, maybe a few flecks of meat, but nothing really substantial to satisfy the hunger. And so the dog reaps only wariness and disappointment. And so, the Buddha says, a noble disciple considers that sensual pleasures have been compared to a skeleton by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. Then, having seen this, thus as it actually is with proper wisdom, he avoids the equanimity that is diversified based on diversity and develops the equanimity that is unified based on unity, where clinging to the material things of the world utterly ceases without remainder. I will explain that phrase when we come to the end of the similes. First, we'll go through the similes. The next simile. Okay, this one. Somehow there's a piece of meat, maybe that somebody has thrown away after finishing their meal. And then a bird of prey, like a vulture, heron, hawk, or most usually in Asia it would be a crow, will come and swoop down and pick up that piece of meat and think, now I have a delightful meal, pick it up and fly away with it. But again, this is something one sees in Asia. When one bird catches something delicious, substantial to eat, there'll be a dozen other birds which are waiting on his tail, ready to claw at him and peck at him and attack and force it to drop that piece of food. And so when our bird seizes that piece of meat and starts flying away, then vultures, herons, hawks pursue it, pecking at it and clawing it. And if that first bird doesn't let go of that piece of meat, then it might incur death or deadly suffering. And so again, the noble disciple reflects that sense pleasures are of the same nature. That somebody obtains some very precious, delightful, wonderful sense pleasure, but when he does so, other people are right after him, trying to force him to give it up. The next is a blazing grass torch. One is holding it and going against the wind. And then the wind blows in the opposite direction, and the fire from the torch burns one's hand or arm or one's face. Then there's the simile of the charcoal pit filled with glowing coals. And then a man comes who wants to live, doesn't want to die. And then two strong men grab him by both arms and drag him towards the charcoal pit. Again, these are very strong similes. But I think the idea in this one is that when people go in pursuit of sensual pleasures, and particularly when they don't observe moral scruples in regard to that sensual, the pursuit of sense pleasures, then they commit all sorts of unwholesome actions which will lead them into rebirth and planes of misery. In the next simile, we have a man dreaming a beautiful dream, seeing lovely parks, groves, meadows, and lakes. And then on waking up, one sees all vanishes. Nothing in it was real, nothing substantial. And so the Buddha has compared sensual pleasures to a dream. That is, one thinks that they are beautiful and wonderful when one first gets them, but after one has enjoyed them for some time, then they become hollow, empty, pointless. The next simile is that of a man who borrows goods on loan. He borrows a fancy carriage, some fine earrings. Maybe today he would borrow a car belonging to a friend, or just rent the car to show off. Well, maybe he doesn't buy a car on this, what he calls, installment plan, though he can't really pay for it. And he might buy or rent jewelry to show off and show that he's very wealthy. And then when he goes out into a public place, and when people see him, they say, ah, that's a wealthy person, very prestigious person. But then the owners see him and they say, you have to give those things back. You're just borrowing them from us. And then when he gives them back, then he feels very dejected. So he's just putting on a false show of being wealthy. And so sense pleasures are of the same nature. This man who borrows the things, he gets a little satisfaction when he's showing off. But when people demand the goods back, then he's embarrassed and humiliated. Similarly, sense pleasures give temporary satisfaction, but in the long run, they lead to suffering and misery. Then the last simile is that of a tree which is laden with fruit, and a man comes who wants to enjoy the fruit, so he climbs up the tree and he starts to eat the fruit, enjoying himself. Then another man comes along who wants fruit, and he thinks that he will cut the tree down and eat the fruit. So he starts cutting away. He doesn't pay any attention to the first man in the tree until, as he cuts, the tree falls and the first man becomes injured or even dies. And so with this idea in mind, the Buddha has compared sensual pleasures to the fruits on a tree. Okay, now we come back to this phrase. Having seen this thus, as it actually is, with proper wisdom, the noble disciple avoids the equanimity that is diversified based on diversity and develops the equanimity that is unified based on unity, where clinging to the material things of the world utterly ceases without remainder. And now this is, again, I wonder how this would have been understood without some more elaborate explanation at the time. Because the meaning depends upon, it has to be filled in by reference to other texts. And conveniently, we have one such text with us in Sutta number 137, paragraph 17 to 20. But to get the meaning of that more fully, One has to take a whole block from that sutta number 137. Where the Buddha sets up a series of contrasts between, there are several sets of six. There are the six kinds of joy based on the worldly life. That would be the joy, the pleasure that arises from enjoying the six sense objects. Form, sound, smells, taste, touches, and ideas, mental objects. So when one gains some delightful form, hears some beautiful sound, smells a beautiful scent, eats delicious food, touches some delectable tactile object, thinks delightful thoughts, then this brings some kind of joy and pleasure. But then there are six types of joy based on renunciation. This is the joy that comes from contemplating, from discerning the impermanence of form, sound, smells, tastes, tactile objects, and mental objects. And one uses, the Buddha says that one uses the six types of joy based on renunciation to overcome and to eliminate the six types of joy based on the worldly life, the life of sensual indulgence. Then there are six types of sorrow based on the worldly life. That is, when one fails to get some sensuous object that one wants, form, sound, smells, then one feels miserable and upset. But the six types of sorrow, there are also six types of sorrow connected with the life of renunciation. And the text says that when one is contemplating the impermanence, change, fading away and cessation of forms, and sees the universal impermanence of all forms, and one yearns to enter upon the stages of liberation, but one is not yet mature enough for that attainment, then one feels some grief or sorrow because of that. And this relates to all six sense objects. Then there are six types of equanimity based on the worldly life. Here the word equanimity is upekkha. But usually in English, equanimity is considered a good, desirable quality. So in the case of the worldly type of upekkha, we might render it instead as apathy or indifference. This is the apathy of the ordinary person, the spiritually undeveloped person. His apathy towards any of the six sense objects. The person who lives in a kind of state of dull indifference, dull complacency. But in contrast to this, are the six types of equanimity based on renunciation. And this is the equanimity that arises when one sees and penetrates with wisdom the impermanence and changeful nature of all form, sound, smells, taste, tactile sensations, and mental objects. And the Buddha says, again, that one uses the six types of sorrow based on renunciation to overcome the six types of sorrow based on the worldly life. And one uses the six types of equanimity based on renunciation to overcome the six types of equanimity or indifference based on the worldly life. But even this equanimity that is based on renunciation, when it is relating to different sense objects, is still called equanimity that is diversified based on diversity. Here, if you look on page 1070, paragraph 17, the Buddha says that there is equanimity that is diversified based on diversity, and there is equanimity that is unified based on unity. And what is the equanimity that is diversified based on diversity? It is equanimity regarding form, sounds, odors, flavors, and tactile tangible objects. Then what is the equanimity that is unified based on unity? It is the equanimity regarding the base of infinite space, the base of infinite consciousness, the base of nothingness, and the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Those are the four formless meditative attainments. But in between the equanimity based on diversity and the equanimity of the formless attainments, there are the four jhanas or meditative absorptions. And so in ordinary sensory experience, the mind takes diversity of objects. Because the objects are always changing. We see forms, hear sounds, think thoughts, taste flavors. The mind is always changing, even if one is very highly developed spiritually, but still there's constant change of the object. The mind is moving from one object to another. But in the process of developing samadhi or concentration, one is leaving aside the diversity of the sensory world, and one chooses a very simple, very easily accessible object, like the breath, or it could be a kusina, a colored circular focal object, and one is directing the mind repeatedly to that object. So even though stray thoughts will arise, but whenever they arise, one lets the thought go and brings the mind back to the object. And so the mind is being constantly focused upon a single object, moment after moment after moment, until as one's faculties mature, then the faculty of mindfulness is being matured so that one is continually attentive to the same object. Faculty of energy is getting strengthened so that the power of attention becomes stronger. And through the combined work of mindfulness or attention to the object and energy or effort, the faculty of mental focus is also being strengthened to the point that the mind eventually becomes fully unified and settled on the object. It enters the preliminary state of concentration. Then when all of these faculties become strong enough, it can enter into the jhanas or meditative absorptions. And as it does so, the mind becomes unified. Unified in the sense that it's not scattered by wandering thoughts, stray thoughts. And it's not scattered by changing objects, the diversity of objects, but it's fully focused and absorbed in this single object, which will be some type of form. And as the power of concentration intensifies in relation to that form, the quality of equanimity becomes more and more prominent within the mind. Till in the fourth meditative absorption, equanimity becomes the defining characteristic of that attainment. So it's said to be upeka sati parisuddhi. It's characterized by the purification of equanimity and mindfulness. And then beyond the fourth jhana or absorption are the four formless absorptions. And in these states, both the fourth jhana and the four formless attainments, the equanimity is said to be unified based on unity. Of course, it's equanimity directed to a single object, an unchanging object, a steady object. And an equanimity in which the mind is perfectly composed, perfectly collected. And so now we go back to the sutta, back to page 472. Okay, now the state of equanimity based on unity is not yet a state of liberation. It's not even a state of wisdom, but it is simply, it's a state of concentration, very, very deep concentration, in which the mind is perfectly poised, perfectly collected, and it's described as a state of, in the text here, a state of supreme mindfulness whose purity is due to equanimity. Upeka sati parisuddhi. And so now, based upon the state of equanimity, the fourth jhana, the fourth absorption, or the formless attainment, the noble disciple can now send his mind back into the past and recollect his previous lives, even in details. That's described in paragraph 22. And again, based upon that pure equanimity, he can develop the divine eye in order to see the arising and passing away and rebirth of beings, to see how they are reborn in accordance with their karma. These are the same two knowledges that the Buddha achieved himself on the night of his enlightenment. And then the third attainment that becomes possible based upon this perfect equanimity, this supreme equanimity, is the attainment of the taintless liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, through the destruction of the taints. What is being compressed here is the whole development of wisdom, by developing wisdom or insight into the impermanence, unsatisfactory nature, and selfless nature of all phenomena. The disciple eventually attains the paths and fruits of liberation, until the fourth and highest stage is the stage of arhatship, in which all of the defilements have been uprooted and destroyed. And that is described here as entering upon and abiding in the deliverance or liberation of mind and liberation by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. And now the Buddha says, at that point, the cutting off of affairs and the noble one's discipline has been achieved entirely and in all ways. And so now the Buddha, in a sense, has completed the exposition, the explanation of how all affairs are cut off entirely in the Noble One's discipline. And now he, in a sense, throws the ball back into the hands of this householder Bodhidharma and says, "What do you think, householder? Do you see in yourself any cutting off of affairs like this cutting off of affairs in the Noble One's discipline when it is achieved entirely and in all ways?" Then Bodhidharma, now he's in a sense been humbled, and he says, "Who am I that I should achieve any such cutting off of affairs?" He's probably living quite comfortably. One would assume that he's, since he's dressed elegantly with a parasol, it's a sign of upper class status. Maybe it's a mercantile family. So his children might have a whole story for him, a suite, what you call a suite of rooms. They bring him his food every day. Whenever he wants to eat, he can eat, enjoy taking nice strolls, living quite comfortably and leisurely, and think that I've cut off all affairs. And so now the Buddha has explained what the true cutting off of affairs means. And so now he is moved with admiration for the Buddha, and he makes a kind of confession that previously he thought that wanderers of other sects, he must have had some affiliation with some of the other ascetic communities of the time, and he thought that they were thoroughbreds. Here by thoroughbreds doesn't mean horses, but a thoroughbred was used as a figure of speech to indicate a well-trained person, a person who's fully accomplished in spiritual matters. And so the Buddha speaks of Purisajaneya. Yeah, the thoroughbred person. And the Bodhidharma must have had also from this paragraph, it seems, almost a contemptuous attitude towards the Buddhist monks, thinking that they were not thoroughbreds. Perhaps because the Buddhist monks didn't observe the extreme ascetic practices that some of the other communities followed, and so the other ascetics would have been observed very austere practices, fasting, and so on. So he might have been an admirer of them. But now he's learned what the Buddha's path to deliverance entails. So now he recognizes that the wanderers of other sects are not true thoroughbreds, whereas the Buddhists, the bhikkhus, the Buddhist monks are the true thoroughbreds. And so now he says that the Blessed One has inspired in me love for recluses or ascetics, confidence in ascetics, reverence for ascetics. And then he declares himself a follower of the Buddha by taking the threefold refuge and asking the Buddha to remember him as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge, for life. And with that, the sutta is completed. Any questions, comments? Yeah.
Sometimes I thought, is it worthwhile to come out to look at the sutta, you know, hear you read the sutta? And this just shows, I read the sutta at home.
Yeah.
I've got nothing like this author. It's really amazing the job you've done in explaining
it. Thank you. When I was coming here, I was thinking, people could read the sutta at home. What do they need me to explain?
Yeah. With the support of the non-killing of human beings, killing of to abandon, be abandoned.
Yeah.
And you know, I thought, well, what could they possibly mean by that? You know? That's an idea. Well, like, okay, I'm on the road, and this road's going to lead somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
The fact that I'm on the road is helping. You explain it so clearly, much clearer than it is in the text.
Well.
I don't say that.
Oh, we didn't pay.
Wait.
We did not
pay. Yeah. Hello, Buddha. Got a complaint.
Well, the Buddha didn't make it.
I said that. I have to say, this is an interesting point, and it seems to me this isn't a complaint, but that the suttas are actually probably, and I've never seen this discussed in scholarly papers, the question, what exactly is a sutta? Is it intended to be a verbatim report of what the Buddha actually said? Or a kind of, what they call a pressy synopsis of what he said? And it seems to me there's a strong case for saying that many of them are sort of compressed, because they had to be transmitted for 400 years or so. They were transmitted by memory. And so if one tried to record and transmit everything that was said in the discourse, it would probably have been overwhelmingly, would have made overwhelming demands on the faculty of memory. So I think to a good extent, suttas had been compressed to make them compact and easy to transmit by memory. And so, like this passage on the contrasting equanimity that's diversified with the equanimity based on unity. Say, if I've never heard any Buddhist discourse before, I come to somebody who's preaching or giving a lecture, and he just mentions this one sentence, I'm utterly bewildered. So I can't imagine how Potalia would have understood on the spot without a fuller explanation. But because the explanation occurs in other places, probably the compilers of the suttas would have felt that they could condense this passage and then expect that those who are expounders of the Dhamma, when they come to this sutta, would be able to elaborate it for their pupils by referring to the other suttas. Yes, Suki.
There was this kind of a
Yeah.
We can go back to the Sutta 10, the feeling. The worldly.
Actually, that's a good point, too. To the Satipatthana Sutta.
Right. Now, it's a little confusion within me. In the Satipatthana, it's divided into like a worldly joy and unworldly.
Well, one could see a movement from the diversify. Wait, say again your point. It just. Yeah, okay, that's a good point. They would seem to be approximations to the equanimity based on unity. Of course, even in the lower jhanas, one is given up the diversity of objects. But in the lower jhanas, equanimity is not yet a very prominent characteristic, because the first three jhanas, the feeling present is one of bliss or happiness, bliss or pleasure. And so equanimity is present in those jhanas, but it is not very prominent, because it's sort of overshadowed by the blissful feeling. It's something like maybe if there's a full moon, but you're in Manhattan, where there's a lot of illumination, buildings have their lights on. You look up at the full moon, it doesn't show so brilliantly in the sky. And the moonlight, you hardly see any moonlight at all. But if you go to, well, if you come out here on a full moon night, and then you look in the sky, then the full moon is very splendid and brilliant, and this whole property of the monastery, it's lit up. You can see that it's so bright in the full moon, light of the full moon. So this is because there's no competition from other lights to overwhelm the light of the full moon.
Well, actually, the real upekkha doesn't come until the fruits of fourth dana.
I wouldn't say that the real upekkha can be present even in sensory experience, but this upekkha equanimity based on unity, say, really comes into its full, blossoms fully in the fourth jhana and above. And also one thing that I should also add, in that the attainment of fourth jhana and these two other higher knowledges, recollection of previous lives and the knowledge of the arising and passing away of beings, are not absolutely essential for attaining the third higher knowledge, the knowledge of liberation. But here the Buddha is showing, in a sense, the complete development of the path, or at least a very complete or full development of it. So this will be a pattern of development which includes the four jhanas and all three of the vidyas, of the higher knowledges.
Unworldly.
Yeah. In fact, the word here, this clinging to the material things of the world, that expression, that material things of the world, is amisa. Yeah, it's the same word used in the Satipatthana Sutta in relation to feeling. Amisa originally means like a lump of food, I think. Then it's used to mean bait, the bait that a fisherman uses to catch fish. Then it means any kind of attractive physical object, any kind of carnal enjoyment. Yeah, did you have... Yeah, that is actually the fourth jhana and above. We'll come to this the full jhanic formulas in a later sutta, so don't worry about it too much now. But that phrase, supreme mindfulness, whose purity is due to equanimity, that is like the capstone description of the fourth jhana, as we'll see. There was a hand.
Yes, I've gotten questions regarding the practice from others, moral good,
yeah.
And seek to avoid dangerous morals. What are like directed towards one, let's say, own being? Now, where does it fit in that you would not do these? For the sake of the other person, see, just about, see, I'm interpreting, just about how I feel about it.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure I understand the question.
I'm trying to say.
This is in paragraphs, referring to paragraph 6.
Two
of the outline.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, but 6 of the sutta, okay.
Yeah, I'm trying to say that to avoid self-blame and all these things.
Yeah. Oh, that is definitely true. There are other suttas which deal with the observance of the precepts from that angle. But here, this is just the particular way that the Buddha is explaining here. Okay, I think we have to stop now. It's almost 8:30. Okay, we stop. We conclude with the transfer dedication of merit. Akasa ta chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodit va chirang rakantu sasanang Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahedika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Desanang Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahedika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Mangparang Etavata Chamehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe devanumo dantu sabasampati sedia. Eta vatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang. Sabe bhutanumo dantu sabasampati sedia. Eta vatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang. Sabe satanumo dantu sabasampati sedia.